going to write on the board this week, because what I am doing is I've got my visual aid that I have all set up to send you. So when class is over, I will send you my visual aid and I will show the sequence. But I'm not giving it to you beforehand because you'll have the tendency of looking at, trying to follow it, and not listening to anything. So we might as well not even have a class. I'll just send you the visual aid.
So what was that? Yeah,
that will come. Were there any questions on what you, besides the weird spellings and the name changes, sort of, that you had as you were studying that came up?
Lesson 8.
Lesson 7 and 8, because we're at
Proverbs 8.
Proverbs 8, Chronicles 11, 2 Chronicles 11 is okay. Where we are, which included Proverbs verses and stuff. Did you have specific questions on things that you, while you were studying, or what was hard to answer for you?
I'm in chapter 11. I have a couple questions later.
Okay. Well, we'll get to them. I just wanted to know. And so when we look at Kings 11, Kings 12, and 2 Chronicles 10, what was Kings 11 about? Who was the transition? Let me do it, start that way. Who was the transition from? Who are the kings that we talk about there?
Rehoboam and Jeroboam.
Well, we get there, but who do we
Solomon.
Start with?
We start with Solomon.
And as we started with Solomon, Kings 11, there were a couple of things God said about him. Do you remember what any of them are?
His heart.
His heart was changed.
Right.
Because of his many wives, that he did not follow the Lord as he had it earlier.
He was not devoted any longer.
No. Right.
So the wives, and we saw that he built their
goddesses and gods and
their temples of evil.
Yeah, and in verse 6 it says he did what was evil, even. Yeah, in the sight of the Lord and did not follow.
Yeah. Verse 5, he calls him just detestable.
Yeah.
The detestable idol of the Amorites.
Oh, and that was Moloch. And Moloch was a terrible god. He
that was
a
fire where they put the babies on his arm and burned to death.
Yes. Yeah. As sacrifices.
Yeah. Babies?
Babies. Yes. Newborn babies. I mean, it was, in many cases, their form of abortion, but it was also their form of worship. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a kid, I would have thought that was beyond horrible, but then I look at what we do, and not a whole lot different.
Yeah.
Just, we don't use fire.
Well, we're even worse, we sell the parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To make money.
Yeah.
To buy those big, fancy cars.
Yeah.
Or a facelift. Mm-hmm. For a long time, they were using the
placenta,
but also the
stem cells
mm-hmm. from the babies.
They still are, aren't they?
No, actually, now they have. Well, they may be, but I can't say no because I don't know everything.
What?
they're using stem cell therapy today, but they're getting it from your own stem cells in your bones. They're taking your marrow out and using that and then putting it back in as stem cell therapy. I think that's kind of cool. If we hadn't have stuck our ground on that one, they would have found no alternative ways. But they had to find an alternative way because it became actual law. So, one of the good laws we've passed in the last 20 years. Anyway, so he had adversaries. Who were his adversaries?
Jeroboam was one of them.
Jeroboam was the third one. Hadad was the first one, needed from Eden. And then Rezon from Zola. So he had, Solomon had three adversaries. I also would put God there. You think about it. So we begin to talk about Jeroboam and God. And how many times did God speak to Solomon personally? Twice that you know him, and then when he's talking to him about this stuff, it's again. I mean, he has another time that he's talking to him. So we know that he specifically talked to him and gave him direction. He talked to him before the temples were built, and he talked in palace, and he talked to him afterwards. And then he's talking to him here. Okay, so in verses 28 through 29, Jeroboam and God speak. And God gives Jeroboam a promise. And this is while Solomon is still alive. What was the promise? Which Solomon hears about it, evidently. So what was the promise, or, you know, to be exact, but what was the promise that God gave him? If he did this, then he would do something. So what was the if?
If you listen to all that I command, and you walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, by observing my statutes and my commandments, as my servant David did, then I will be with you and build you an enduring house as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you.
So we would have had a second nation there, a whole different thing with a different source and different roots, because Jeroboam was not related to David, but God knew too. And he said, he even said, I will afflict and give Israel, I will give Israel to you and afflict David's descendants, but not forever, not always. So, verse 40, we have Solomon sought Jeroboam's death, and we see that he dies instead. So that's the kind of the finish of Solomon's being king. Jeroboam comes up on the scene, and then Solomon dies, and Jeroboam goes to Egypt because Solomon was persecuting him.
Solomon must have got word that he had this thing happen, heard from the prophet or whatever. You know, Solomon's found out, evidently. So
yeah, I guess when prophets speak out, they're not particularly silent things.
Mm-hmm. Well, he kind of met him in the field alone, but evidently word gets around.
Not to mention, who knows what Jeroboam did with it.
Exactly. Yeah, he may have been right.
Then we get to Kings 12. So what is Kings 12 about? We have Solomon dying in 11. So what is 12 do? Where does it start? We have Rehoboam came. Mm-hmm. His son. So Solomon's son, Rehoboam. And where did he become king? Where did he go to?
Shechem.
We remember that because we get Shechem again later, don't we?
Right.
And what were the people? The people came to install him as king. What did they ask him?
To relieve them of taxes and bondage.
Yeah.
They were asking that he would lighten up the load.
Well, and Jeroboam was in with that group.
He came back.
Right.
He had
so
gone.
He came back because he heard Solomon
right.
died. He came back,
right.
And actually, I think he was probably the spokesman, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like he was, because they have him in forefront there.
Yeah.
So, Rehoboam did what to that question?
Consulted with the elders, told him to come back 3 days later.
He consulted with the elders and who?
And his
young
friends.
Men.
And his young men. So what did the elders say?
Yeah, you better lighten the load.
Why?
Well, because the one that they had before, the fathers had put on them, was too great, and that they needed to lighten the load because they didn't need that much anymore, and the people might rebel.
But
plus, if they serve them, then they will be.
Right.
They said, if you serve them, mm-hmm. they'll serve you forever.
Right. So the elders saw the people of Israel as someone to be served.
This is your option.
Did Jeroboam see it the same way?
No.
He was to be served.
He was to be served. And you kind of get, I mean, when you go from David, as we think about David, he came from a meadow filled with sheep and very little to become the king over a long time, mind you, to become king of Israel. So he's a man whose roots worked hard, right? And he remembers what life was like before he was king. So it kept, in that very sense, it kept him humble. In fact, God's last statements of him in the chapters were that God saw him, everything he did as right, except that it says it, except that Uriah thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then Solomon comes. What kind of life and livelihood had Solomon had up to this point before he became king?
He had it easy.
He had it easy. And his brothers went out to fight, but he did not. He stayed around the house. You're almost getting... He's a monitor. Mm-hmm. So he's a little weaker. So he is weaker. And his son, Rehoboam, has never seen war. If you think about it, because David was a man of blood and war. Solomon was a man of peace. So Rehoboam comes along, unless he knew of his grandfather well, or was alive when all that was happening, which I don't think he was. What he knows what it's like is the king's in charge and everything is good. So when it comes down to what the elders are saying, he does not have wisdom at all. And he's not seemingly not seeking wisdom. Because had he sought wisdom, he would have asked why. And they would have said to him, your father had to have money to build the temple and to build a country and a nation. You no longer have to have that. So you lighten the load to let them know you're paying attention to them, and they will know you are listening. So, and that's what he's going to be indicted for, and that's what the country's going to divide on. He did not listen to them. And so what did they say when he came back with his edict?
Let's go to our house and take care of this house.
What have we to do with the house of David?
We have nothing. It's not what to do with the house of David as much as it's, the house of David has nothing to do with us. We're kind of thrown out here and abandoned, and we're not of Judah, so we're not those special people, you know. And they went to their own tents. What?
To our tents, O Israel.
Yeah. They said house or home or something, and then what they go to is the tents. So we know they're still living in tents. There's only one that's in the palace and has his own little fancy-dancy stuff. Okay, so that was Kings 12. And actually, it's comparative to 2 Chronicles 10, which has many of the same things. If not all of them. We added there on that one that Rehoboam sent Adoram, to be over forced labor. What did Israel do with this now that they've been disenfranchised?
Stoning to death.
What do you think that's saying? If he is the man over the forced labor like Jeroboam used to be, What are they saying when they stone him to death?
We won't be forced into labor.
We're not slaves. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
And what was Rehoboam's response?
He made haste to Jerusalem.
Why Jerusalem? Besides that he lived there.
Because
it's safe. It's his people. Judah's his people. That's his heritage. Right there. So, and 2 Chronicles 11 also continues comparing with Kings 12 and the dividing of the kingdom with Rehoboam coming to Jerusalem. So, let's see, where are we? So verse 1 through 4 we've gone through, and that's where we start to see in comparing. It said that verse 3, speak to Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, king of Judah, to all Israel in Judah and Benjamin. So that was the Israelites who were there in Judah and Benjamin. You shall not go up or fight against your relatives. God says, you shall not go up or fight against your relatives. Return every man to his house. For this thing is from me. And so they listened to the word of the Lord and returned from going against Jeroboam. Now that's there. This is going to change quickly. In 2 Chronicles 11:4, they return to their homes. They're not going to fight him.
Then Rehoboam fortifies the whole country.
So he begins the process of fortification. When he does this, what is that telling us? Did God tell him to do this?
No.
But he's feeling scared.
Yeah. Which is kind of why he went to war, isn't it? So if he can't go to war, his personal answer is fortify. They got to tell
and
him.
And build up an armory.
He built up lots of... He built up fortified cities in both Judah and Benjamin.
He must have thought they would change their mind and come after him.
I think he lived out of fear. We talked about that last week. If you are a proud person... and you're not humbled in the sight of the Lord, and your trust isn't in God, you run to fear and anger very quickly, and anger will turn into fear. So his response is kind of what the survivalist is. He also strengthened the fortresses and put officers in them and stores of food and oil and wine. He put shields and spears in every city and strengthened them greatly, which is a little bit different than was there when Solomon was king, because what did he have that was a little bit different than this?
Horses and chariots.
He had whole cities that were set aside for horses and chariots and the men that had to ride them. So verse 13 through 17... you start to talk about the sacrificial system of Jeroboam. What do we learn?
He set up his own priests.
He did.
And he did the two golden calves. And I found that whole thing very interesting, because there were still Levites in his part of the country, and they had been to Shechem before, because that's where the tabernacle had been, you know, when they came there. And so they had Shechem, which could be a place of worship if they wanted to do legitimately. And he was afraid that they, if they went to Jerusalem, that they would all turn against him and everything like that. So he had another option besides setting up his own priests and the two golden calves and that whole business, and he chose not to.
And I don't think it was just that he was afraid they were going to turn against him.
Well, one
he
of
was
them
afraid
said
his people were going to turn.
Yeah, that's what I meant. His people would turn against him if they went to Jerusalem.
Right.
So
and
he set up that whole system, which he really didn't need to if he thought about it.
Well,
you know,
once
wanted
again,
to be right.
What was the basis of his doing it?
He didn't trust the Lord.
Yeah.
He didn't trust
yeah.
the Lord.
Therefore,
so
he was fearful of losing this new position he's beginning to enjoy.
He couldn't see how God could do something different. You know, God had promised him. It's like, oh yeah, it looks like that's the way it would go. But he couldn't see God could do differently.
Yeah.
You know, I have to wonder, and I think of our own culture, our own Christianity, our own churches. The question becomes, if we don't do it the way God does it, do we really believe?
I think we do the same thing. He chose something he didn't really have to, that because of fear or whatever, you know. We do the same thing. Maybe God's way seems a little tough and a little hard and
taking a long time
or something like that. So we go ahead and do it our own way.
Or did he really say that?
Yeah, there we go.
And also, I think a lot of it is pride. I can do it better.
Well, not better than God. We'd never say that.
Well, no, but he's thinking,
I'm right here, and I know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm here. This is my kingdom. Nobody's going to divert to Jerusalem. I'm going to hold them here because this is mine.
Sometimes we just think.
Well, he had seen some of the priests already deflect, because it says that those who believed went with Judah.
Yeah, they left their country.
They left their country. They had
the
all
the Levites and the priestly
Exodus.
Line of Aaron.
Yeah.
They deserted and
they
went back to the temple
to be able to still worship the God of heaven.
Well, because Jeroboam refused, you know, refused their worship and put it in his own man.
Yeah. And he wouldn't let them do anything.
No.
You find it interesting about the golden calves, because he knew about the golden calf from way back in Aaron's day. So, you know, he could have made other things. He didn't have to be a golden calf, but you see, he got something kind of similar,
yeah,
but yes, it's off the track.
Yeah.
Well, and you could, what did God say about all that? We even talked about that last week. Did God acknowledge that Moses would, that Aaron was okay with what he did?
No.
Did
but
we
kind of
miss
that part?
So that's what I go back to, and we have to ask ourselves this. And I don't mean, I'm not saying for us that it means we don't believe in God at all, okay? Because we maybe do, but we're reading what he says, and if we make the statement, but I can't do that. I can't be obedient all the time. I try, I can't do it. Which we've all said, by the way, some level, mm-hmm. some way, do we believe? Because I think that when we get into trouble, it's because we don't believe. And the thing that you confess first is not the sin that you did. It's the sin of unbelief that you have. Because I believe, help my... It's exactly right. And I think that we're always at that point of we should... You know, people say, well, how can you get there? I think the answer is as soon as you come up to with something with, I'm not sure I can do that, or, you know, wherever your mind goes to, that's the time to stop. We have a tendency of just going on, and then we keep getting into the same sins. Stop then. Stop then and say, God, I have no idea how to believe this. This is beyond my comprehension. I need you to take me there.
Yes.
Because we can't manufacture faith. And we can't know it. What is the source of faith?
God's grace.
And it says Jesus, think of Hebrews.
He's the author of our faith.
Jesus is the author and perfecter. So we have enough faith to believe in him, but not enough to accomplish that next step, whatever that next step is. And that is the time to say, I am not going to move until I know what you want. I am not going to move until you give me the strength to do it. And then stop making decisions that turn up into sin.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't that you're sitting there saying, I'm not going to sin. It's, I'm not moving until I make choices that follow him. That until I make choices that aren't the choices of sin. And that's how we learn to follow him. Because then we're turning our eyes off of what? To him.
Our sin.
Ourselves, our sin, our fears, our lack of humility, our worry, all of that stuff. We're turning our eyes off of that stuff to him and waiting. We have such a difficult time waiting. We may be fine with procrastinating. That is not the same thing. Procrastination is not the same as waiting.
No.
It's just holding my eyes and not doing anything. But waiting is keeping my eyes on him and seeing he is the answer, and I don't go forward until that answer comes.
Yeah.
How are you doing with that?
It's a safe place to be.
That's the safe place. That's our Jerusalem.
That's what I took from these two guys in this divided kingdom, you know. That's what I took away from that. Even though it happened thousands of years ago, we're not that different.
Mm-hmm. Which is why he has those stories for us.
Yes.
He's testing us, too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Don't do what they
do.
So
that we learn about our own thoughts.
And so we see why we made that choice.
Right.
You know, if he tells me to be humble, I cannot be humble. Pride is natural for all of us. So I have to ask him for humility and waiting for him and looking upon him and doing things his way and giving him my wants and desires and things I'm in essence stealing from him. My giving it to him is humbling. I'm not humbling myself. Humility is the knowledge of who he is and who I am.
Yeah.
And I always just say the kids, we're just worthless spit without him. That sounds pretty gross in Bible study, but nevertheless, when you're talking with boys, you have to be very careful. But because of him, I have every value throughout all eternity. And he had purposes for me before I was even born. And that goes for every one of us. So humility is knowing who I am and knowing who God is. And letting go of the fear, the worry, the trying to get in position, trying to get out of position, whatever it is, it's just letting go and letting him do what he wants to do. Because what is he doing with us? What is he doing with your life between now and the time you die?
He's transforming us into the likeness of Christ.
And we want that desperately, but the thing that stops it is us. Fear. I have a better idea, God. I don't want to do that. I want to do this. You know, whatever it is, it's the thing that stops that transformation.
I think we don't know who God is very well when we don't believe him. Because
that's right.
Jeroboam couldn't see how God could do it differently. Mm-hmm. So he took matters into his own hands. So we don't need to see how God's going to do it. We just need to believe He's going to do it and walk in His ways, walk in the light we have.
I think one of the funniest things and the hardest things at the same time is to think, on one hand, that picture is stopping right here and only taking a step that he gives me. And yet, on the other hand, he tells me to plan. Mm-hmm. So how do I do both of those? Well, I don't plan my hair. I don't plan my steps. I plan what he wants to do with the things I'm doing and having here. Anyway, okay. So, so Rehoboam appoints the false priests, and they have their system set in place, and he is
Jeroboam.
Oh no, I'm actually looking at Jeroboam, yes, but I was looking at Rehoboam right there. Then we move, so we move from Jeroboam and his false priest to Rehoboam and his family, and we are introduced to one of his wives, actually two of his wives, and one of them is going to be the mother of the next king. And we see her name spelled here, M-A-A-C-A-H.
Right. Where are you at?
I am in 2 Chronicles 11:20. And she bore who that is going to be the king?
In this Abijah.
Okay. So, Rehoboam loved Micah, the daughter of Absalom, more than all of his other wives. And it tells us how many wives he'd taken in, how many concubines, and how many children. And then he appoints his son. He's preparing. He's actually discipling him. What does he do to do that? Verses 22 and 23.
As head and leader among his brothers. So, he put him
so he's
in
giving
charge.
Him leadership qualities and skills and giving him a chance to work that out, isn't he? So that's actually very wise fathering.
Yeah, he's being wise because we saw in David's day that the brothers ended up getting killed because David didn't really
father them.
Yeah.
Mentor them.
Yeah, he didn't. Well, you know, and you think about him, what was he doing? He was out in the field by himself, so what did he even see of his father really doing? You know, teaching him how to do and be things.
But he spent a lot of quiet time with God in the field by himself.
So that mm-hmm. relationship was strong.
Yeah.
We even see David's family later on coming to him when he was in the caves. But they're a little weird. And as we look later on, we even see that David's father had three wives. So what that all meant, we have no idea. How that all went together, we have no idea. Because he doesn't tell us. But here's Rehoboam, and he appointed Abijah as head. And then he acted wisely, and he said he distributed some of his sons through all the territories of Judah and Benjamin. For what purpose? In 23.
They were over the fortified cities.
So they were going to the fortified cities. He sent them through all the territories. Why would he do that? What position did they play in those fortified cities?
They were like a supervisor, an overseer.
Governor.
Yeah.
And then they're the ones he would trust because they were his kids. And it says he gave them food in abundance and sought many wives for them. I think that's pretty funny, but that's a very odd statement. Okay. So we had cross-references, the one in Exodus, which we saw Jeroboam following as an example on the altars and in the calf. and the worshiping, and he also sees Aaron kind of trying to pass it off as their fault. When it says he let them get out of, Moses saw the people were out of control, for Aaron had let them get out of control. So whose fault was it?
Aaron.
It was Aaron's fault. He not only allowed, but promoted this worship of another god. And he even called it God, the God who let him out of Egypt. So what was God's answer to Moses? What did Moses have to tell the people they needed to do? In verse 26-28.
They had to bring all their gold earrings and jewelry.
That was Aaron.
Coach Bessel?
Pardon?
Are you asking about what
What did Moses
do? That he had, they melted the calves down and he had them drink it.
He did. And then what did he go on to do in verse 26 through 28? He used all the sons of Levi, and what did he gather them to do?
They killed all the offenders. They killed them.
At that point, what do you think those that changed in those Levites, or what were they thinking? If you were told to put a sword on your leg and go through and kill the people, it says, brothers, mm-hmm. men, his friends, and his neighbors, what would that do to the Levites? If you were asked to do that,
that's a hard
thing. To that first thing,
it's a hard
first
thing.
Person you were supposed to kill, what would you be thinking?
I can't do this.
Yeah.
But who told you to?
God did.
So what is your decision right then?
Right.
It has to be to make the decision to follow God rather than man. And for the Levites of all the people, they had to follow man. They had to follow God over man, because man was going to keep coming back with things that were going to be in against God. I think that has got, I mean, the picture is horrible. But it also makes sense when you think about the position the Levites were in. And as you get to Rehoboam and Jeroboam's time, what did the Levites do? They left all their land. They left everything they owned to follow God, to do what the Lord called them to. Now, they were in it for the land that they had and the stuff they were going to get. They weren't going to get that. That was what they were leaving to follow the Lord, to be able to worship. Could we do that? Could we leave everything we have and every person we know to follow the Lord, to be able to worship Him freely? That's what faith is. Faith means leaving everything behind. Even if you're still here, it means leaving everything behind. Making that choice. And those are hard choices. And every time you think about making a choice for against what seems like to you, against a friend or a family member, remember this. Because that also puts them in a place where God deals with them. You don't. And sometimes we become roadblocks to those things, the things that God is doing in the life of someone. We stand in there instead of God, and we need to get out of the way.
Oh,
I wasn't saying anything specific to you. The Lord got to talk to him about it.
You're just letting the Lord use you.
Well, I kind of hope that's true. Okay, so is there anything you wanted to add from our Hosea 4, 1 through 6 verses? What is a verse that was hard to read? The first one, listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel, for the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land because there is no faithfulness or kindness. That's an interesting combination. Faithfulness or kindness, or knowledge of God in the land. And it goes on to say there's swearing and deception and murder and stealing and adultery and employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore, the land mourns. Does our land mourn?
I think it does too.
Verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge because you have rejected knowledge. I also will reject you from being my priest since you have forgotten the law of your God. I also forget your children. And the reason it's important we focus on priests is what are we today in this world?
Priests.
We are priests. That's what he's called us to. So everything we learn about the priesthood and how God used them and what it costs them, we need to remember that is us. We are the priests in this world. We are the ones who stand on behalf of God and before man, and to God on behalf of man. Because who has a voice with God but his children? By smooth, Daniel 11:32b, by smooth words he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly towards the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. Okay. Anything you wanted to add from Luke 14? How about Deuteronomy 13:6-11?
We're looking to see where we're at.
Page 84.
Yeah. What is it?
Page 84.
Well, what should have happened here? Oh, okay. Like what he was doing. Turning away from God's way. Nobody should have followed him.
Yeah.
Not when he showed where he was going.
Not when he started going.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really easy for us to be angry at one thing and therefore think the other thing is the right thing. They were angry at Rehoboam because he was not wise and he did not listen to them. But Jeroboam turned away from God totally. I remember years ago when I was teaching in a Christian school, and a lot of the kids that were in that Christian school were there because their parents were angry at the public school. Not because they were Christian, wanting them to love the Lord or growing with the Lord, but because they were angry at the public school, so they were punishing them. Well, guess what? The Christian school is going to have a point where they're also angry at the Christian school, and then what do? They go back to the public school and punish them. What are they not doing? They're not doing what is right because it's right. They're not seeking what is right. They're not fighting through the difficult things, which is usually themselves, to be where they are. So it's the same with this kind of thing. You know, they go back and forth. Well, they're both wrong, and so it's what should they, when they're both wrong, what should they be doing?
Seeking the Lord.
Seeking the Lord. Where he may be found. Okay, then we'll go on to Kings 13. 1 Kings 13. What do we have in 1 Kings 13? Verse 1. Behold, there came a man of God from Judah to Bethel by the word of the Lord while Jeroboam was standing by the altar to burn incense. So here is Jeroboam at the altar that he made burning incense. And he cried against the altar by the word of the Lord, and he said, O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah. By the name and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you. Who's he talking to? Jeroboam there. Incense on you and human bones. I never knew this before, by the way. I don't know why that never clicked. And human bones shall be burned on you. Who's human bones?
Priests.
The priests of
Jeroboam.
Of the high places. Well, it's going to be much later than that because this is about 300 years. This is a prophecy in 300 years from now. He even gave him a name, Josiah. Now, we can look at that and think, well, you know, his father just named him Josiah because he read this. For those of you who in your life have studied the time of Josiah, did they have the Word of God?
No.
No, they did
not. Probably clean the temple.
Josiah found them. He found those scrolls that they hadn't seen for generations. So nobody knew that name, except for God. So behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, talking to the altars, and human bones shall be burned on you. Then he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be split apart, and the ashes which are on it shall be poured out. And when Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him. What happened?
The man drunk.
Right. That'd be a little
and
scary.
And he couldn't bring it back.
Oh, so what was it? What did he then?
He was called for them to pray for him.
Well, and then the altar was split. All that stuff was happening, assumably, while his arm is...
So the altar split apart. The ashes were poured out from the altar according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. The king said to the man of God, please entreat the Lord your God. He didn't say the Lord our God, did he?
No.
The
Lord your God.
And because he obviously knew that guy's God worked. His doesn't work so well. Entreated the Lord, and his hand was restored to him, and it became as it was before. And the king said to the man of God, come with me and refresh yourself, and I will give you reward. What happened?
Well, he says he...
What did the man of God say?
No way.
If you were to give me half your house, I would not go with you. You saphead. Nor would I eat bread or drink water in this place.
Well, why?
Because it's a simple
thing. God had told
me. God said, don't do that.
God had commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, you shall eat no bread, nor drink water, nor return by the way which you came. So what did he do then?
He went a different way.
And where did he come to?
Bethel.
Which is what? That's another false place.
Yeah.
It's where those calves. So we went from one calf place to another calf place. Now what did he come across to here? Where was he living?
Bethel.
Okay, knowing that, without going any further, who's he an old prophet of? Do we know?
Mm-hmm.
He could be an old prophet of God's. He could be an old prophet of this new thing that was going on. We don't know what he was. But the reason it's important to think about this is because this man of God comes in and he sees this old prophet, and what does he do with him?
He obeys
the old prophet. Now, he's had a word from God himself that has told him, eat no bread, drink no water, nor return by the way you came. And he left. But here's this old man. And this old man is telling him what? This old prophet.
He lies and said, God's told me that you're to come with me.
Kid, I have a question.
Sure.
Okay, back here. The king heard the saying of the man of God which he cried against the altar in Bethel. Were they in Bethel at that time?
Like,
or is it just that?
Well,
that's
he
where
said,
the,
let's see.
That's verse 3 and 4.
Right.
So if they weren't in Bethel, he was condemning the altar there in Bethel.
He was. Yes, but he had to be where Jeroboam was because he's
Well, he was at the altar in Bethel.
Well, it says there came a man of God from Judah to Bethel.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm confused about these Bethels.
Yeah. Right. Well, actually, there were a couple of them, but I don't know if that's what it's talking about. An old prophet was living in Bethel. So his sons came and told him what that man of God had done in Bethel. The words that he had spoken to the king, and these relate, they related to their father. And what did their father say?
Which way did he go?
Which way did he go? His sons had seen the way which the man of God who came from Judah had gone. Then he said to his sons, what?
Saddle the donkey for me.
Why?
So he did.
Went after the man of God and found him.
Under an oak. And he asked him who he was and if he came from Judah.
He said, I am.
He said, I am. And then what did he say?
Come home with me and eat bread.
He said the Lord had told him to come back with him.
I think this is kind of an important place for us. And I know it doesn't seem like it would be, but it is. How many times has God shown you something in his word, in your life, and somebody who calls himself a believer, a Christian, has a different statement to you?
Yep.
Yeah.
What are you going to believe? Now, I know we all know the right answer, but truly, what are you going to believe? Why would God have spoken to you and said what he did and then turn it around through someone else? Unless there was wisdom involved in it. This is not talking about what God's word says. It's not. It's talking about the man of God who listened to God, who heard God, who knew God's voice, and then this old man said what he did. Why did he obey that?
Right after he told him what God had told him. Because the guy says, come home with me and eat. And then the man of God says, I cannot go with you, nor will I eat bread or drink water with you in this place. For a command came to me by the word of the Lord, you shall eat no bread nor drink water. Do not return by going the way which you came. Then this old prophet says, I also am a prophet, and an angel spoke to me. Bring him back with you and your house that he may eat and drink. But he lied to him. But
you can know, if you are standing there and somebody does that to you, can you know that it's a lie?
Yes, because the word of God is true. And what if somebody says contrary to the word of God, then it's a lie.
Yeah, but this guy sounded like he had good credentials. He got his word from
an angel.
He said,
"So what was his faith in?"
But the word doesn't
say. Is the angel greater than God himself?
No, but can you see him standing there in a quandary? Well, this might be okay.
And he's an older man. I need to have respect for him.
Yes.
All of that.
Well, what he didn't do was bother to ask God then.
Exactly.
And his own flesh was saying, "I want to eat." Mm-hmm. So there was two things: flesh and life.
Well, and I think sometimes, like in a position like this, I think it's just hard sometimes because, like you're saying, it sounds good. He's an older man. I don't want to assume that I'm this, know more than he does. But for whatever reason, you turn, and it doesn't always have these horrible consequences, but I think sometimes we do that and just say.
I'm just thinking. Yeah. Why would he say it if it wasn't true?
Right, exactly.
He was thinking his own stuff, not bothering to consult God.
Yeah.
And he was probably also hungry and thirsty.
If he was a prophet, well, of course you want to hear the prophet say.
And you think, okay, this is new information, maybe.
That one of the hard things in our lives, honestly, and I'm talking about a humble person, one of the hardest things in our lives is to say, I'm standing on this because I know what's right. Mm-hmm. And I know it's right because this is what God has told me. Do you realize how difficult that would be to stand in front of someone else and say, I cannot do what you've asked me to do because God has told me this?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds arrogant, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially if it's a person older. And
it's supposed to be
a relatively new Christian and somebody you have high respect for.
you know, in my early days of my Christian walk, I went through this thing and ended up going north when I should have went south. And suffered some bad experiences from it because of the individual that I really had respect for and the counsel that was given to me, even though I wasn't really sure that was what God wanted me to do. But I can see how somebody who, you know, isn't really rooted and grounded in the Lord, and I can see how that would be tough. Yeah.
I think if somebody's even rooted and grounded in the Lord,
it's still tough.
Well, this is a man of God. He should have been grounded.
Well, I think, again, we go back to what I said earlier. Then we stop there, and we say, God, I am not moving a step until I know what you want me to do and what you are saying. And the hardest thing for a younger person is to stand up to an older person and say, no, I'm not doing this, because it sounds arrogant. And remember when we were studying gifts, I said, I don't know if you remember this, but one of the hardest things for me to do was to learn to trust my gifts, which meant I learned to trust that God was speaking through what he had done and what he had given me. And I needed to trust him in that. I wasn't trusting my gifts. I wasn't trusting myself. But I was trusting God through the gifts he had given me. And there were many times I went in places that I would never have gone because I knew that's what the Lord wanted me to do, to be, to say, to think, to walk in. And so what that is actually doing is laying aside yourself. You're learning to lay aside yourself and hear him through the means he has given you for his purposes. It isn't for you. It's for him. And for this man of God, again, whether he was hungry or not, he needed to have stopped and listened to God. Wouldn't it have occurred to you that if God told you to do this and you did what you were going to do, that if you were going to have a cost? And it wasn't that God was punishing him. This is the cost of going the wrong way. He told him not to go a certain way because he knew that the lion was there.
Yeah, he told him not to eat the bread and stuffing.
Which is a time thing. All of those things. Whatever it is, I don't have to understand it. I just need to obey it. And that's what we, that's again why we stop and we wait and say, I'm not moving until I know what you want, Lord. He's not going to starve to death. Okay. So we have the lion. What did that lion do?
I have a question just before that.
Yeah.
Okay, so he went back and he ate, and then the Lord came to the prophet. Is that the same person that the Lord's now going to talk to?
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
What was this? Where are
verse 20. The you prophet says, I'm also a prophet. He lied. And the man of God goes back and eats. And then after they had eaten, they were sitting down. The word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back. And he cried to the man of God who came from Judah, saying, thus says the Lord, because you have disobeyed the command of the Lord and have not observed the commandment which the Lord your God commanded you, you have returned and eaten bread and drunk water in the place of which he said to you, eat no bread, drink the water.
Right.
So that's my... So God used that...
Same guy that lied to him.
He also used Balaam. He also used the donkey. You don't have to be a man of God for God to use you, to speak through you. That's one of the things, that's why we have to look at people's lives. When God wants to say something to him, he said it right through that prophet who lied to him. Yeah. Which condemned the prophet, too. And what I don't understand personally, because I don't understand what Israel did and what it meant with all this, was why the thing of the being buried in his grave.
Yeah, I don't understand that. And your body shall not come to the grave of your father.
Which was basically a curse. That's a curse.
Well, and the same
but
thing
the
for
body of the prophet went and got the body of the man. And buried it in his own grave.
He wanted his sons to bury him next to him.
Right.
Too,
we see the same.
I don't understand
curse.
That at all.
Well, to me, it's a curse.
Yeah. We see the same thing with Jeroboam's descendants too.
Yeah, they're wiped out.
Yeah.
Except for one.
Except for the young boy. But he said, you know, going to be eaten by dogs and going to be eaten by birds and not going to be buried in the graves.
Okay, I'm confused. The guy that got killed by the lion, is he the old prophet or the other guy?
No,
the
man of God.
The man of God from Judah.
Yeah.
And so the man of God was buried in the grave of the old prophet, and the old prophet wanted his bones buried next to him. I think that was a curse throughout history.
This is the old prophet here.
Which is, I don't know what is in the head of the old prophet, to tell you the truth. That's the one I don't really understand.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to try to figure that out, because the prophet, the old prophet.
Right.
Okay, who's who in the Book of Life?
Well, that's why he says the man of God, because the man of God was a young prophet.
Don't you think the fear of God would be struck in that old prophet?
Mm-hmm. I think that's why he cursed himself and put the man in his grave. This is a personal thing. This is a personal thing. I don't think the old man ever heard from God, the old prophet. But I think when he spoke God's words to him, he knew what it was like to be a real prophet. And from that point on, I'm assuming it humbled him, and he either sought the Lord or just knew he was cursed. I don't know, but I know that this is a different situation. You can't lie to a man of God and not know that God is going to hold you accountable if you believe. And if you've really spoken God's words before through you, you don't play with that. So I think this may have been where he became a believer, if that's what it's all about. I don't know. But I know he knew he was wrong.
In verse 32, though, he does say, "For this thing shall surely come to pass," which the young prophet, you guys, that he cried by the word of the Lord against the altar of Bethel and against all the houses of the high places, which are the cities of Samaria. So he's saying it will surely come to pass what this other prophet said. Mm-hmm. The old guy said that.
Yeah.
So I think God used him.
It changed him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think there's a Jeroboam in it.
I think there's a warning for us as mature Christians to be very careful what we say in advising younger people.
Make sure it's the word of God.
Otherwise, we will be held accountable.
That's exactly right. You can never be wrong if you're pointing to the word of God. And as a counselor, I don't give counsel that I can't go back to God's word to, because who am I? You know? I mean, really, who is anybody? What you can do is have wisdom on their situation, and honestly, a good counselor, biblical counselor, can see through the lies. Because God is convicting and can see where someone needs to go, wants to go, or is ready to go. They may not be ready to go there. You don't say things when they're not ready to go there. But it's all about the Lord. You're just a mouthpiece pointing them back to God. And sometimes we need those things from one another, because we're kind of blinded by our situations. And like I said, sometimes, especially in family stuff, our love is so confused in theirs. That's why a doctor doesn't perform on his own family surgery. Because you end up laying aside all you've learned, and all you can do is see that person. Well, it can be the same thing for us. You know, we love our family so much that we maybe aren't the one to make the wise choices here, and we go to someone else and ask for a sister to pray with you on these things. Okay, so verse 33, Jeroboam, what was Jeroboam's response after this event, which tells us this event became known?
He did not return from his evil ways, but again he made priests of the high places from among all the people. And he who would be ordained to be priests in the high places.
And what did that event also do?
Became sin to the house of Jeroboam, even to blot it out and destroy it off the face of the earth.
So there's an end. Okay, that was the end of lesson 7. Lesson 8. We started with, actually, 11:37. 39, I will take you, and you shall reign over whatever you desire. You shall be the king over Israel. And this is his promise to, that's just to remind us of what his promise to Jeroboam was. Back to 13:33 and 34. And again, after this event, Jeroboam did not return from his evil way. So did he believe that prophecy that was given to him in the first place in chapter 11? Because what was God's, what did God demand from him? If you do what?
Walk in my ways.
Walk in my ways.
Well,
then,
if he did, he forgot it.
You know,
well, I don't think
you.
He believed it.
I don't think he believed it either, but let's say he did. Who is the promise to? It's to his heritage. Maybe he just wanted to live
house.
His life and get
yeah.
it now, rather than wisdom, which would want to pass it on to the generations following. Okay, chapter 14 of Kings. Ahijah prophesies against the thing. What does he say?
Child is going to die.
He said the child was going to die. What did Jeroboam do to find out?
He said his wife is a prophet.
He's a prophet.
Had her disguise herself and take some loaves and some honey and
after
some cakes.
After all, he's old and blind. He wouldn't know the difference.
Don't you think this is a little funny?
Yeah.
It's funny to me, too, that he sends his wife out.
Yeah.
You know, you go out. So she went, and she did what she was told to do. And what did the old this old prophet do?
He wasn't fooled.
The Lord left him, gave him a message that she mm-hmm. was coming. And
so there, once again, God is actually speaking to a real prophet, and that the woman was coming, and she would pretend to be another woman. Mm-hmm. And what's his first statement to her?
Come in, wife of Jeroboam. Are you pretending to be another woman?
I like that one.
Why? For I am what?
Sent to you with harshness. So she coming to him, he's giving her a message.
Yeah.
Could maybe Jeroboam be hoping that he would give a message to her and not know who she was so that
so would be okay.
So everything would be okay. So he'd give her a different message than he would to Jeroboam. That's because he's gotten into the role of superstition. And he says, let's see, he said, go say to Jeroboam what? Verse 7.
Because I have exalted you from among the people.
One.
And made you leader over my people Israel.
Two.
And tore the kingdom away from the house of David.
Three.
And gave it to you.
Four.
Yet you have not been like my servant David. Who
five.
Kept my commandments.
Eight.
And who followed me.
B.
With all his heart, to do only that which was right in my sight. You also have done more evil than all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourself other gods and molten images to provoke me to anger and to have cast me behind your back.
That's what he was hoping not to get. He was hoping not to hear that little speech.
Yeah. Therefore, behold, I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male person, both bond and free, in Israel. I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one swept away dung until it is all gone.
So what did he just call him?
Dung.
A pile of dung.
A pile of leavings.
And anybody who dies in the city, who's going to eat them?
The dogs will eat.
And anybody who dies in the field?
The birds of heaven will eat.
Who belong to Jeroboam. Why? For the Lord has spoken.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, as we think about this, what is a high place? You were supposed to start to think about that. You were also supposed to, if you wanted to, look up Exodus 34. What is a high place?
It's a place of false worship.
It always carries, whether in the plural form, it always carries with it overtones of dominance and control.
Mm-hmm.
It's associated with heights, with lordship.
Sort of a game King of the Mountain.
Pardon?
Sort of like the game King of the Mountain. Somebody conquers the mountain, you know.
Something like that, yeah. Then you're the
poor
king
analogy, but...
That makes you the bad guy when you're the king of the mountain. After the
But it's anti-God, whatever it is. It's anti his place of worship.
Mm-hmm. It's a threat to the purity of Israel's faith.
Yes.
After the distribution of the kingdom in 922 BC, the Bahamut, or whatever it is, posed a new threat to the purity of Israel's faith in the northern kingdoms. Jeroboam built houses of high places as part of the campaign to distract the subject's attention away from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Thus he made Israel to sin, for the high places, though often nominally dedicated to God, clearly included many Canaanite features, such as images, standing stones, Asherah poles, sacred prostitution, and other fertility sites. And when we think about Solomon actually was installed in a place of cultic worship. So there was sort of a transition period until the temple came about, where it was sort of iffy-ish. But when the temple came about, which is why it makes sense that Jeroboam would not want people being faced towards Jerusalem, because that's where the temple is. And when you would do that, you would have to do it God's way, with God's Levites, with God's priests, and God's word in the temple. So he was drawing them to a false god to keep just worshiping. Man has a need in himself to worship, but it's not necessarily gods that he's worshiping. And we can be worshiping gods that are not the God of heaven. We will see what happens when Josiah becomes the king, because it's going to be far-reaching. But even after him, the successors, the shrines came back. So we see Asa did what was right in an attempt to suppress these high places. So let's keep on going. But, Grace, you read to
12.
12. Then he tells them to rise and to go to their homes. When their feet enter the city, the child will die. And how did Israel respond?
Well, Israel mourned him because something good was in him.
And something that good towards God.
And he alone of Jeroboam's family will come to the grave. Nobody else will. So
he's the only one we're going to see of his family in heaven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's funny, when I read that, it was one of the first times I felt like I had a verse that maybe told me not to, when you die, what do? When you go in the... get your body burned, what is that called?
Cremation.
Unless maybe you put it in the ground. Anyway, this is an interesting verse to me. Then he said, moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel. This is again another prophecy, who will cut off the house of Jeroboam this day and from now on. For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. He will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers, and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates River, because what?
They have made their Ashram, provoking the Lord to anger. So the scattering beyond the Euphrates, is that sort of where, like,
what is it? It's a visual of returning back to the gods that...
Well, but is that present day, like, Iraq and those kind of countries, that area?
Yes. Yeah, I don't think we
know they have false gods there.
Right.
He will give up Israel on account of the sins of Jeroboam, which he committed, which he made Israel to do. So that's also another interesting verse. He's giving it up on account of the sins of Jeroboam, but one of his greatest sins is that he made Israel itself to sin. Mm-hmm.
So it really all falls on Jeroboam's shoulders.
Yes, it does. And that's the hard part about being a leader. If you are even if you're a godly leader, it all falls on your shoulders. That's why I think in the church we have elders, not elder. because when you have a multiple of elders, they make a much better choice and decision, and waiting should anyway, until they hear what God wants them to do. And there's a better chance of that happening. If it's on the shoulders of one person, you're either going to get somebody who loves that and is a dictator, or you're going to get a very overwhelmed man. It's a hard thing because you know, if you're the leader and you know you should be waiting for what God says, and the church is going, I want an answer now, you're put in a very difficult position.
Mm-hmm. But David gave a very good example of that. I'm always running to God over and over and over.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's, I think, why we have those pictures, isn't it? And why God keeps reminding us of that. Like David, whose heart belonged to him. David, whose heart was seeking the Lord. And we really don't learn a whole lot about the other. The more I read about this, you're not learning a whole lot about these other kings except for their best or their worst. You know, David, you sort of watch him for a long time. Okay, so... So how does Kings 14 end? Because it's about Jeroboam. It seems to be about Jeroboam. So Kings 14 is about Jeroboam.
Okay. Well,
in verse 20, Jeroboam reigned 22 years and slept with his father. But then in 21, it picks up Rehoboam.
Well, and then Nadab was reigned in Jeroboam's place, whoever Nadab is.
And so this is what we start to watch, don't we? Father dies, son is reigns. Yeah. And it tells us for how long.
Israel's case, there were no good kings.
There were no good kings.
Well, Jeroboam reigned 22 years. And then we go into Rehoboam when we turn the page.
So in Rehoboam, what do we learn about Rehoboam, son of Solomon?
He
reigned in Judah.
Was 41 years old when he became king.
How long did he reign?
He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem.
And then I like the rest of that.
The city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And Rehoboam's mother's name was Naamah the Ammonitess.
So why do we get the mother's name?
Must have some importance there somewhere.
Well, for one thing, it makes us know who, because these guys marry how many women?
15,000.
So they tell us where this right. kid comes in. Yeah.
Well, and that's their influence growing up.
Right.
Is in the harem thing. Is the mother
and
who gave
she's
birth
an
to
an Ammonitess.
Yeah.
Is she of Israel?
No,
she shouldn't have married her, but.
They were one of they were the ones that I believe, if I'm thinking right, did the Asherim, worshipped the Asherim.
Well, and they were also, who was Molech? Wasn't he of the
Ammonite god? Yeah.
Yeah, he was an Ammonite god. So this, so Rehoboam
they're all
not
bad
getting
guys.
Exactly the best training.
Well, it goes on to say Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord. They provoked him to jealousy more than all their fathers had done with sins which they committed. They built themselves high places, sacred pillars, and asherims on high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree. There's also
what verse
male,
are you in, Grace?
24.
Oh, okay.
Male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord possessed before the sons of Israel. And wasn't Israel told to destroy everything, even
yes,
down
so
to the
were.
Last?
So we're beginning to see how it's being built up, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in those high places. And it's because those kids, like we said earlier, Solomon married women who were foreigners.
Yeah.
And therefore his
he
children...
He could have very likely chosen a wife for his son, too.
Well, and
which
also,
often happened.
And also, he allowed them to bring their foreign gods
yeah.
with them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which is the point. I mean, it just takes a little bit. I mean, this is huge. But it just starts with one thing for that to all be accelerated and rolled into the pit. So the Lord dispossessed them, but it is a picture of seeing how everything was brought back. I mean, we have been following Israel where they have gone through and taken the land. They've done what God has called them to, not perfectly, not always, but taking the land and going to war. That was why David couldn't be build the temple. But what are they now doing? They have the temple in Jerusalem. This should be a time of strength, and what it has been because of Solomon's disobedience, and Solomon probably didn't think it was that big a deal. Solomon went back and brought back into Israel through his wives that which was which a whole generations fought to accomplish.
Yeah.
They lost it because of the very same thing. So that which was, that's why we see that the nations basically are repositioning themselves through, and that's why God wanted to show Israel or Judah what it looked like to follow the God of heaven versus the gods of these things. And we're about to get there. So let's get there. Verses 25. And it happened in the fifth year of the king of King Jeroboam. I always like the way the Bible does it. Finishes something, then goes back and adds a whole bunch of stuff. King of Rehoboam, that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came on Jerusalem. Now, who is he, and what did he do, and why is he there?
He's the one that, was it Jeroboam or Rehoboam, ran to? And took care of Jeroboam for all those years, so he's the king of Egypt. And he protected Jeroboam from Solomon.
So he probably knew what was there in that time, didn't he?
Well, in Second Chronicles, we have Second Chronicles 12 as a correlate,
a
cross reference, and it gives a lot more detail about the king. Second Chronicles 12, verses 2, and it came about King Rehoboam's fifth year, because they had been unfaithful to the Lord, that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem with 1,200 chariots, 60,000 horsemen, and the people who came with him from Egypt were without number, the Lubim, the Sukim, and the Ethiopians, and he captured the fortified cities of Judah.
So it didn't do any good.
And came as far as Jerusalem. And then, yeah,
and
but
we'll
that
get
gives
back
you.
To that. Okay.
Yeah.
So hold on to that.
Yeah.
So back to Kings.
He came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house.
In verse 26 of Kings 14. Yeah.
And he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made.
Well, it's always a mystery to me, like this. It says he took everything. And then it seems like everybody who comes in is going to take more stuff still the temple and from the and then when they go into Babylon, there's still more everything, because some things are left there and some things Nebuchadnezzar takes, and so there's always more of everything.
Well, they keep rebuilding too, because it tells us that they replaced the shields of gold with shields of bronze. They're continually replacing it, whatever that means and whatever that looks like. But we know even when the second temple came after the first one was destroyed, it got less.
Mm-hmm.
Each time it got less
and
smaller, because it wasn't the original that God had put up. Mm-hmm. So it happened as often as the king entered the house of the Lord that the guards would carry them and would bring them back to the guards room. Then verse 29, the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And then this is a verse we begin to see a lot of. There was war.
Mm-hmm.
Here was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually.
But wasn't Rehoboam told not to fight against Israel at this?
Yes, he was.
And
what is also, but it says he planned the war from the beginning.
Yeah, mm-hmm. By fortifying
the
cities.
And he's the one who fortified the cities.
Yeah.
And we see, what does it tell us about his son? His son was raised with what?
More.
His whole life.
Yeah.
He saw a war his whole life. So that nation, which was to be a nation of peace, based on the trust that was going on in the temple and the worship of God, was now back to being a war because of man's fear. Everything that was re-entered the kingdom. And we can do the same thing. We can clean out our kingdom really well and let it come back little by little if we're not paying attention, if we're not watching. That's why he tells us to be watchmen. Okay, so Rehoboam slept with his fathers and the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah, which we saw. And now this is another one that I think is funny because it changes his name a couple of times. Abijam. His son became king in his place. So, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam became king. Abijam. That's not right. Abijam. Yes, thank you. But I like Abijam better. Abijam. It looks like that in English. He reigned 3 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Ir. Micah, or Micah, the daughter of what turns out to be Absalom. Who's Absalom?
David's son.
Keeping it in the family here. He walked in all the sins of his father, which he had committed before him, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father David. So there, throughout all history, all the hearts of the kings are going to be compared to what?
David's
heart. Mm-hmm. He was their paradigm. But for David's sake, the Lord gave him a lamp in Jerusalem. What does that mean?
Somebody to hold the word.
The light of his family name. To raise up his son after him and establish Jerusalem. Because David did what was right in the sight of God and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life. And I get this kind of picture. Well, you know, except that case
for
Uriah.
I didn't understand that. Why does that say that?
Well, because you're
that's the only place
Bathsheba
I mean, where does that say that he didn't ever turn away from?
Except for
Uriah. Yeah.
But he did repent from that, did he not?
Well, there's a difference between turning your away from and being in the process of growing, and I think that's what he's telling us. There are times you walk right into sin, and then you suddenly know that that was sin, and you didn't determine to do it. You just ran right into it. I think sometimes when we listen to others, we've run right into it, and now we're learning to discipline. Have you ever had to take a pill? This sounds really silly, but it drives me crazy. I have to take insulin, and I'm supposed to take insulin about a half an hour before I eat. I'm the one cooking. What am I thinking about?
Cooking.
Getting it on the table, feeding the, you know, blah, 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 blah. The last thing I'm thinking of is that dumb insulin, and then I'm halfway through dinner or 2 hours after dinner, and I remember,
I forgot it.
I didn't take my insulin. I go back and take the insulin. So the blood sugar actually goes higher than it would have had I taken it at the right time. It's a discipline. I have to learn every single day, every single meal to do this thing. And sometimes I think that we can get in that kind of situation where we get our mind on what we're doing and we forget to do what's important.
Yeah, like my husband opening the door before he turns off the alarm every day. Right. I said, look, don't remove the stick that pulls the door thing and your hat until you turn it off. But no, were you at the house
well,
one day when he did
he's
it?
Got the discipline down. The only problem is it's doing
it
the wrong
is.
Thing.
It is.
Right after.
I'm going, oh, please, you're killing me.
I just think it's so easy to do that. And to be in charge of every thought means you really have to work on thinking, and those are hard things, but those are, and we, you know, I bring the shot out because it's silly, but it's not silly when it comes to spiritual things, and again, we get our minds on what we're doing. You're not sinning, but it can lead into it because you're not thinking about the right things. Okay, so then we come, let's see, Come to verse 7 and 8, and what do we learn there?
The rest of the acts of Abijam and all he did, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam. And Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Asa, his son, became king in his place.
Asa's going to be a little bit of a surprise.
No, it's the first one. Just the first eight verses.
Right. We only did the first eight verses, which means we'll come back to it. And 2 Chronicles 12 through 14, we only do the first verse in 14:1. So where do we did look at Chronicles up to about 5. Do 4 to remind us. He captured the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. And Shemaiah the prophet came to Rehoboam and the princes of Judah who had gathered at Jerusalem because of Shishank, and he said to them, what? What did the prophet say to Judah?
And which one is that?
Keep going.
So the princes of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, the Lord is righteous. And when the Lord saw that they humbled themselves, the word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, saying, they humbled themselves, so I will not destroy them, but I will grant them some measure of deliverance, and my wrath shall not be set out on Jerusalem by the means of Shishak.
But
they will become his slaves, so that they may learn the difference between my service and the service of the kingdoms of the countries. So Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem and took the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's palace. He took everything, he even took the golden shields which Solomon had made.
So, going back to verse 7 and 8, when it says he grants them a measure of deliverance, I think if we turned it around, we would understand it in our language a little bit better. If he granted them some measure of deliverance, it means he gave them not punishment, but discipline. Mm-hmm. He gave them a measure of discipline. He didn't pour out his wrath on Jerusalem. But what did he do? And what does that mean, that they may learn the difference between my service and the service of the kingdoms of the countries? What is his service? What is the service of God?
Righteous.
To train and to discipline us. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. When he says my service, you are still, when you know when we read in the New Testament, it says doulos? Mm-hmm. The slavery that we call it servants. We are God's servants. We are his doulos. It really isn't the word servant. It is the word slave. Mm-hmm. So yeah, when we become believers, we are slaves. Yeah, Grace, go ahead and tell you.
Where the slaves were freed and they stayed with their master and they put an earring in their ear, something
right.
like that. To show that they had freed, but remained in the service.
But remained in
the rest of their life.
Remained slaves. They remained
slaves.
So the
picture is, God is saying, they're going to understand the difference between being my slaves versus being the slaves of the nations. Because they are a heavy taskmaster. And they are not doing it for the sake of growth and discipline and maturing. But God is. So you may go through what you think is a hard time and a hurtful time, but he is using it to grow you up, make you like Jesus.
And weren't the slaves of the nation more heavily put upon than being the slaves of God? I mean, you know, like, they weren't free, they were...
Well, when you think of the difference, when you think about Rehoboam when he came in, why did Rehoboam end up dividing the country? Because he wouldn't listen to the people. Does God listen to you?
Yes.
Doesn't mean he's going to do what you ask him to,
but
he's listening to you. You are important to him. You were his child, just like a parent. You have never said yes to everything your parent asked you, or you're a terrible, I mean, your child asked you, or you're a terrible parent. because they ask terribly stupid things. So God is the same way. He's doing what is right and best for us. Are the kings of the nations doing what is right and best for us? They don't care about you.
Best for them.
You're there to be their slave, to do their bidding, to do their work, just like Rehoboam. And the people knew when he came in and he did not listen to them that that's what was going to happen to them. And so what is the first thing he does? He sends out his head of labor. They kill him because they're going to tell him we're not going back to slavery. Right? So that's what's being said here in verse 8. Let's see. Okay, so it says the king entered the house of the Lord, verses 10 through 12. The king Rehoboam made the shield. Okay, and in verse 11, he entered the house of the Lord. The guards came and carried the shields and stuff back to the guard room. And verse 12, and when he humbled himself, the anger of the Lord turned away from him so as not to destroy him completely. And also conditions were good in Judah. So then what happens in verse with King Rehoboam in verse 13 and 14?
Strengthened himself and reigned 41 years and reigned. He was 41 years old when he began to reign. And he reigned 17 years in the city of Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there.
I love that stage. Keep saying it. That the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there.
And again they named his mother.
And verse 14.
He did evil because he did not set his heart to seek the Lord.
So how can we define evil by that statement?
To seek the Lord.
That's how we define evil.
To not wholly seek the Lord with our whole heart.
With our whole heart. Then the acts of Rehoboam from first to last, are they not written in the records of Shemaiah the prophet and of Edo?
So are those writings still around, like the writings of Edo the seer?
I have no clue. I kept trying to... for some reason, I have heard that Edo, or what, however you say it, Edo, had something to do with Isaiah, but at this point, I haven't found it out. So when I do, I'll let you know. According to genealogical enrollment, and again... There were wars between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. How long?
Continually.
And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, and his son, Abijah, became king in his place. Chronicles 13. In the 18th year of King Jeroboam, Abijah became king over Judah. He reigned 3 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Micaiah, the daughter of Son. And then there was, what does this say?
War between them.
Abijah and Jeroboam. Jeroboam just hangs in there, and they just keep having war. Abijah began the battle. So he began the battle with an army of valiant warriors, 400,000 chosen men, and while Jeroboam drew up in battle formation against him with 800,000 chosen men who were valiant warriors. Okay, so what went on the mountain of Zemaraim in the hill country of Ephraim? What did Abijah do?
He spoke to the army of Jeroboam.
And what did he say?
He said that we have followed the Lord's commands. We have kept our priests. We have followed his ways. So I think there's three or four things he pointed out, the difference between Judah and Israel.
Mm-hmm. He said...
And says that you have forsaken him, but we have not forsaken him.
Yeah.
You know? And the sons of Aaron are ministering to the Lord as priests, and the Levites attend to their work. Mm-hmm. So he's saying we have truth.
Right.
Do you know, verse 5, that the Lord God of Israel gave his rule over Israel forever to David and his sons by what?
Covenant of salt.
Anybody figure out what that is?
I looked that up in Leviticus, and it was a covenant that God had made with Aaron and Aaron's sons.
Okay, now I want you to hold on that, because that's absolutely right. And who does Aaron stand for?
The priest.
So he is a paradigm of the priest. Here in Chronicles 5, who is he giving, talking about the covenant of salt with?
David and his sons.
David.
David's sons.
Who is a representative of what?
The kings.
And then in the last verse that they gave us, which was Numbers 18:19, anybody read that one?
Yeah.
And actually Leviticus was through Aaron, but it is actually with Israel. It says, mm-hmm. when you bring, I'm going to Leviticus 2:13, when you bring the grain offering which is made of the things to the Lord, it shall be presented to the priest, and he shall mm-hmm. bring it to the altar. So who is bringing the grain offering?
The people.
So where would the salt be?
Well, the people have it, and they're bringing it.
So they would put it in with their grain.
Right.
And I'm just briefly, this is a picture of us sitting down and having a cup of tea and some cake. And the salt represents that we're sitting together communing. So when God is doing this with Israel, he is sitting down with them and receiving communing-ness, mm-hmm. a dinner, so to speak, or a lunch, or a buffet, or something, with the people of Israel. So God and the people are sitting together. On our verse in Chronicles, God and the kings are sitting together, communing. And here in in Numbers, all the offerings of the holy gifts which the sons of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you. So who is getting the offering? Well, you don't know because you don't know who you are. You is Aaron.
Right.
I have given to you and your sons and your daughters with you as perpetual allotment is an everlasting covenant of salt before the Lord to you and your descendants. So that is a picture of God communing with Aaron and all that he represents, which are the priests. So the three times the covenant of salt is talked about in the Bible. One time it is saying, I'm sitting with the people. Another time it is saying, I am sitting with the kings. And the other time, last time it's saying, I'm sitting with
the priests.
And the salt,
I thought it meant something about preservation.
Well, it can be that too, but that's the real outlook. The symbolism here is a picture of us sitting together. So when you give an offering to God, you're not giving it to him and, you know, leaving, and you're not attached to it anymore. You're actually attached to it, and you're having a relationship with him. It's a relational statement. The covenant of salt is.
Could you tell me the reference for the covenant of the salt with the king?
In our verse, which is verse 5.
Oh, okay.
Of
2 Chronicles 13.
Chronicles. Okay,
yeah.
There you go. It took me a long time to find that, because there is not a lot on it.
But then in the New Testament, salt was what the Roman soldiers were paid. Mm-hmm. For salary, salt, and Jesus says, "You are the salt of
the
world."
The earth. Well, there's a lot of different representations, mm-hmm. but this is talking about a covenant.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. and it's attaching. It's still an attaching to that covenant. Back with Moses in Moses' time, it would be attaching to the law, but it's past the law, and so. It's actually more talking relational, I think.
Yeah.
Here. Anyway, we are done. You know what I just realized? How long are we supposed to go in this class?
11:30.
Is it 11:30 or quarter to 12?
Yeah, I thought it was quarter to 12.
I think it was 9:45 to 11:45.
Oh,
okay.
When
we changed the.
That's what I thought too. But I was thinking about it and said, you know, we changed it so many times. I didn't know what was coming. And I don't ever mean to hold on to it, and I tell you I will.